Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I'm joined by the much-loved actor and comedian Sanjeev Bhaskar. Following a late arrival into comedy, Sanjeev was catapulted to stardom in the comedy series Goodness Gracious Me, and later The Kumars at Number 42, both bringing the British Asian experience to the masses and to international acclaim. This success, which has led to decades of movie and TV roles, has taken Sanjeev all over the world. India, of course, is a big feature today. Sanjeev has filmed documentaries and written books about the country where some of his family still live. From Delhi and Rajasthan to Shimla and Darjeeling, Sanjeev paints such a wonderful picture of such a diverse and exciting country. And he transports us to the American city he first fell in love with, his European all-time favourite, and we chat about the new season of his hit ITV show, Unforgotten, which is back for its fourth season. In fact, there's so much to chat about that this is a long-haul, feature-length episode. So let's get started. Here's Sanjeev. Sanjeev Bhaskar, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for asking me. What a pleasure and an honour.
Oh, it's my pleasure entirely. And on this gloomy winter's day, I am just so looking forward to being transported out of these four walls of my home, which I've seen far too much of recently, and taking a journey through the seven chapters of your life's travel diaries so far. Starting at the very beginning of your life, that is chapter one, which is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
It would have to be India. And it was only because we didn't take holidays. My parents, it's an immigrant thing, actually. You never move to another country as an economic migrant in order to have tea breaks and holidays. You move to work. And my father was very much of that mind. So, you know, the trips to India, although they were, I suppose, in one sense, holidays, they were really there for them to see their family. Mm-hmm. But those are that's the earliest one that I remember. I was seven, and I have a fairly good memory. I've got a fairly good long-term memory. So my first ever memory is 2.5.
Wow.
And I remember things, you know, incidents, kind of, and anecdotes clearly from 2.5, 3 years old onwards. So at seven, I remember it all really very well. You know, the feeling of getting on a plane at Heathrow, it was a jumbo jet.
Was that exciting?
Incredibly excited. I still have that sense memory of being, you know, at a sort of 30 degree angle, you know, once you've taken off, and feeling like I was in a dream. And, you know, we went in economy. It's not like we went posh. But the whole experience of airports and then airplanes and then, you know, you get in this, you know, you leave a place that you know, which for me was London, and you get in this plane with all these other people that you don't know, and you're mainly sitting for 10 hours. And in those days, the, you know, in-flight movies was a screen they pulled down at the front.
Yeah.
That you had to watch.
Smoking at the back.
Smoking at the back, yeah. Obviously, I didn't do too much of that at seven. and then you land, and it's still the thing that gets me. You land somewhere completely different. And that's extraordinary to me. You know, you come out of the plane and into an airport. And airports, you know, broadly look the same. But then suddenly you come out of that and you're into a world, immersed into a world that you don't know and you don't know as well. And that's fantastical to me. And so at seven, I remember that really clearly, getting out of the aircraft, going through customs, coming out to this massive humanity on the other side.
Where in India were you?
That was in Delhi. So we would land in Delhi, and my father's mum, so my grandmother on my father's side, lived in Delhi and shared a really small place, small flat, with my dad's sister and her kids. So that would be our first port of call, and we'd be there for maybe a night or two. And then we would get on a bus, on a coach, that would take us to Karnal, which is in the state of Haryana, which is about probably about 3 hours on the coach.
Right.
Out to my mum's side of the family, and that's where we mainly stayed. It's memorable for lots of different reasons, actually. I mean, firstly, because we were going for a wedding, and so, you know, the extended family were there. So suddenly there's these, you know, thousands of people that you're related to.
Yeah.
And I don't think we didn't travel very far, because this was in September. So I'd gone in September of that year, and we'd gone for a month, I think. That was the plan. And then the Bangladesh war started, and so we were stuck there. And we were not, we were in, you know, Delhi is sort of northwest India, and so it's closer to the border of Pakistan, and when Bangladesh is on the east. And so when war broke out, it broke out on both sides. And so I've got that bizarre experience of having lived through a war experience.
Yeah.
In that there were, you know, the air raid sirens would go off. There'd be blackouts. Mm. You'd hear sort of, you know, fleets of bombers going overhead.
Wow.
We were told, you know, that, you know, when the air raid sirens went off, if there was a bomb attack, that we had to get under a table. And then I remember one of my cousins saying, actually, the corners of the house are the safest places, because they're the strongest. So, you know, we had experienced all of that. And that went on for 3 months. So I remember we came back to London on Christmas Day.
My goodness.
I think the war ended probably, I don't know, 2 weeks before. But the flight back was on Christmas Day.
So did you feel a sense of relief then, leaving India from that first trip that you remember? It must have been very frightening as a young boy.
It was, I have to be honest, it was all exciting.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
well,
because I think...
good. Good it didn't traumatise you.
No, because I think at seven, I mean, you're just old enough to know what the repercussions could be, but you live in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was lucky as well that, you know, my mum's side of the family were incredibly funny and humorous and, you know, compassionate people. So, you know, they were very mindful of not transferring any further stress to the children. Mm-hmm. So they kept it interesting for us and kept it light, I suppose, and all new. And I was in a country that was new. So, you know, the food was different and the way people spoke was different and, you know, social rules were different. And so I, you know, I just came into something that was once again different, but in a way that was new to me. You know, in a way, India and wartime were both just as new to me.
And taking the kind of wartime element out of it then, having grown up in London, I mean, I actually have never been to India, but from what I've heard from so many people is that when you land there, it is this immediate assault on the senses, sights, smells, sounds. It's just a cacophony of excitement.
I experience that every time I go to India, even now, you know, and I think that India's one of those places where I've never, you know, people have one of two reactions. You know, they tend to either say, I love it, or I couldn't stand it, you know, Costa del Sol from now on. And I've never heard anybody who's gone to India for the first time and come back and you kind of say, how was India? And they go, it's all right.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never heard that reaction.
Yeah.
And I think it's because, as I did a documentary series where I went around India for several months, and I remember writing a book after that about it. And I remember saying in that, thinking about it and saying that India's not convenient. You know, you can't, because it is so overwhelming, massive humanity, smells, colors, sounds, you know, extremes, poverty, wealth, and there's no place you can turn away from it. You know, I remember thinking, actually, even in somewhere like London, if there's an area you don't like, you can kind of skirt around it, you know. And in India, you kind of couldn't, because if you looked away from something that was overwhelming, you'd just see something else that was overwhelming. And in a way, it plugs you into the human condition in a way that I've never experienced anywhere else.
Hmm.
And, you know, I had to, I remember as a seven-year-old, one of the things that really struck me leaving the airport was seeing, you know, children my age begging. And that was something that really threw me. And in order to try to deal with it emotionally, I think I had to look at how the adults around me were dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older and I, you know, went back and, you know, you experience seeing the same sort of things, it was that not that they were not compassionate about it, it was that they accepted that this was also a facet of life. And yeah. So, you know, and so life, birth, death, everything are just facets of existence.
Mm.
And that, I think that's the way I kind of managed to deal with it then and still do in a way.
And your parents left their homes behind during the partition of India, which must have been deeply distressing for them. So how do they relate to India now and traveling to India themselves?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it, that, you know, most of the people who were displaced by partition, I don't, you know, it's no coincidence that most of the people who were displaced by partition were the ones who then made their way to the West. And I think that, you know, for them, leaving, you know, ancestral lands, which they may have had a connection with for hundreds, if not, you know, 1,000 years, to move to another bit of India that they didn't know, I think was a bigger trauma than leaving India to come to Britain or Canada or America. Because they'd already been displaced. And so I think that that trauma for that generation, I mean, you know, that generation is remarkable in that, you know, there were, you know, it's the biggest migration of people in history. You know, 15 to 17 million people were displaced by partition. Yeah. And they were given weeks to pack up and go. And in fact, I know that my uncle and my grandfather both left after the partition date, simply because they could not believe that their home and the town that they lived in would change. I mean,
and the town that they lived in was
that they were both from both sides of my parents were from a place called Gujranwala, which is just outside Lahore, which is now in Pakistan. So they made the trek eastwards, as many Muslim families did, westwards. And yeah, they just didn't believe that. They kind of went, oh, this will calm down after a while, surely. It can't, you know, it can't sustain like this. So it was that trauma, I think, for them was bigger than the trauma moving to Britain.
And is it something that they have made peace with now when they return to visit extended family in India itself?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think I got, in retrospect, I think I got a very, you know, diverse view of India from them, because I'd certainly got a pre and post partition view of their experiences. And, you know, pre-partition, they, you know, obviously much younger and they were children, and it was, there's a degree of innocence and perhaps rose-tintedness to it. And post-partition, my father was a refugee in Delhi. My mum had family on the India side and was slightly younger, so it was slightly different for her. But yeah, I think they made peace with it fairly quickly, actually. I mean, it's, there's this thing about, you know, the whole thing about living in the moment is that you deal with whatever you have to deal with, you know, that's in front of you. You're not dealing with kind of existential stuff. You're just dealing with the immediate here and now. And I think that that's probably what pushed is not a word. I mean, evolved them into a state of kind of like calm and satisfaction about it.
And that's a great approach to life generally as well.
Yeah, I think it's what I do. And I think I must have got it from them, actually. You know, it's
that's great.
It's, you know, people can, you know, you have to kind of know your past to know why you are where you are and the direction you're going in. But, you know, so many people live either, you know, in the past or a fear of the future, that their present kind of becomes the casualty.
Mm, very true. So moving on to chapter two, that is the first place that you fell in love with. Where would that be?
Well, this is a tricky one. I mean, for most of these answers, you know, you're not going to get one answer. You're going to get
that's fine with
at
me.
Least two. So as a kind of immediate, you know, gut response, New York.
Uh-huh.
as soon as I kind of arrived in New York, I just loved it. And I still do. It's one of my favorite cities. Driving from JFK into Manhattan, there's a point where you turn a corner and you see that skyline for the first time. And it is the closest thing to a man-made mountain range that, you know, one will ever see. And it's so extraordinary. And it's that weird thing of, you know, being so familiar from television and from movies that I remember, first landing in New York at JFK and stepping outside of the terminal. And there was a cop there who was, you know, he was incredibly overweight and he had a coffee in one hand and he had a donut in the other. And it was like he'd come out of Central Casting. And, you know, and he said, you want to get a car to New York? It's into Manhattan. Okay, you know, better not take the FDR because, it gets blacked up at this time. And I just thought, I'm in a movie. This is just, this is extraordinary. And I suddenly kind of realized, I think, with New York, how long the streets are and the boulevards are and how tall the buildings are, the inherent drama of the city, there's obviously not many old buildings like you'd find in European capitals, but the scale of it. And I suddenly thought, oh, okay, now I think I get why there have been so many writers and songwriters and stuff from this place. It's inherently dramatic. So I think New York was certainly the first city that I fell in love with. Mm-hmm. And as a country, Italy. I think, and I'm sure we'll come back to Italy at some point, but yeah. Italy was just, I mean, every time I've gone, it's the only place I think I've been to where you every kind of 100 yards, you either see something of historical importance or aesthetic beauty or somewhere to eat.
Oh, exactly.
On a loop.
Yes. Where was the first place that you went to in Italy?
First place I went to, and I set the bar very high, was with my missus, with Mira. We went to Amalfi.
Oh,
and
gorgeous.
That Amalfi coast is just breathtaking, just breathtaking.
Another dramatic set almost, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember kind of opening the window to our hotel every morning and turning around to Mira and saying, it's still out there. It was kind of unfeasibly beautiful. So yeah, from Amalfi and then, up the coast to Positano and Naples and Pompeii. And it was just an extraordinary trip. And we've gone back to Italy, I think, maybe 4 or 5 times since.
Oh, lovely.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Well, one thing that I thought was quite curious that I didn't know about you was that you went to university and studied marketing. So did the taste for acting come later in life, or was it more that the opportunity or the ambition came later?
No, I think I wanted to act since I was about three.
Oh, very young.
Very young. And I remember that some friend of the family came round, and I was maybe four, maybe five, something like that. And he said, "Well, young man, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "Actor." And my dad said, "It's pronounced doctor." And which my dad then denied, but my mum was there as a witness. But yeah, from about four, five, really, really early on, I was not just acting. I was obsessed with films. And
so
certainly by the age of six, I remember reading books I just didn't understand about filmmaking and the kind of equipment they used and how they did scenes in films. And so anything about filmmaking, I was slightly obsessed with and still am. And it took me to 34-ish to actually get around to doing it.
That's incredible.
And that was because it wasn't seen as feasible. I mean, there was, my parents thought it was, it was the same as a kid saying, "I want to be an astronaut." I want to be, the three things I remember little kids used to say, mm-hmm. When I was at sort of junior school, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" It was kind of like fireman, astronaut, and pop star. Those are the three that kind of, and so, a kid of, that age saying, "I want to be an actor," you just lump in the same category as astronaut. Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Mm. So it just didn't seem feasible to them. And I remember at school, I didn't do GCSE drama out of a fit of pique, actually. Now when I look back on it, it was, I thought I was easily the best person at drama in the class. Mm. And they did the school prizes, and they gave it to some third rate person who, let's face it, we've never heard of since. And, and I think, and I kind of went, I was so upset at not even being in the frame of not being acknowledged that I said, right, hell with it. I'm not going to do GCSE drama. So I didn't do any productions at school.
Oh,
didn't do any of that
that's
stuff.
That's so sad.
It's only when I went to university and to do my marketing degree that they had a drama club that would meet twice a week. And I went and joined that. And then those are the first productions I ever did. And I remember thinking then, God, if I'm not better than the people who are doing it in their spare time, then I really shouldn't be thinking about this. Maybe I'm just fooling myself. But I did, I thought I was better than them.
So that low-level burning desire was there the whole time?
Never went. Mm. I mean, I think my first access to it was to start writing my own material. And I was really lucky. A real life-changing moment for me was meeting Nitin Sawhney, who's now, award-winning record producer, composer for film. Mm. And he was studying there as well. And we kind of connected as friends, and we decided that we said, "Oh, why don't we just put on something together? It'd be a mixture of music and comedy. We'll be really unpredictable because no one's going to expect that from two British Asian lads." Mm-hmm. And so I wrote material for that. And 7 years later, after that, we were still doing that in little theatres with Oval House Theatre in London, South London. We played there. And a producer from the BBC came to see it, knocked on the door afterwards and said, "We're thinking of doing a sketch show. This is the kind of material we're looking for. Are you interested?"
Huh.
And so, yeah, life changing.
Rest was history.
Yeah. Ongoing, hopefully.
Yeah. Is history. Yeah, exactly. I mean, without sounding too cheesy, I just think that's such a lovely story of it's never too late to pursue what you really love.
No, and also, thank you, yeah. I think it's also, it's never too late to pursue a passion. You know, whether that passion becomes an occupation is a different matter. And it kind of, there's a number of things that need to fall into place for that to happen. You know, right place, right time, a huge degree of good fortune. But your passion for it and pursuing the passion is something that you can do at any age, absolutely any age. And I think in a way, something I tell my kids, which is that, you know, I had no idea that my passion for film at 5 or 6 years old would lead me to being involved in it. But it never stopped me from not being passionate about it. You know, the end game wasn't a job. There was no end game. I just loved it. And so, you know, I've always had more in common with someone who is passionate about whatever it is that they love than I do with a fellow actor who's whinging about what they do. But the importance of having a passion or, you know, discovering a passion, I think is something you're not really taught at school. You know, people discover it at school. You know, they love English or they love reading, or but there's so many kind of interesting things. Travel being one of them. You know, you kind of you know, a passion for travel is something that it. I mean, it's the best education you can possibly get anyway. But it's experiencing it. My uncle, my dad's brother, who lived here most of his life, and I remember saying to him, you know, when he retired, I said, "Well, you can travel now," and he said, "What's the point?" I said, well, you know, see new things, experience new things. He said, you know, I'd see it all on the telly. I said, well, about the food? He said, well, I could order it in. And I thought, I don't really know who you are. You miss out on so much. You miss out on all that nuance.
Well, that leads me very neatly onto chapter 3, which is the place where you learnt the most about yourself. Where in your travels have you had the most meaningful self-discovery?
Well, at this point, we return to India. It is the place that I've learned most about myself, because I think that as a kid being born in London, despite the fact that I spoke and sounded more English than anybody around me, I was still an outsider. It was the way I looked and my name, and, you know, and I was regarded as not in the club. And suddenly when I went to India, not just at 7, but, you know, subsequently, well, suddenly I was in a place where everybody looked like me. And and yet I didn't entirely fit in there. You know, I was, you know, I could speak the language. I could read the language. I could, you know, communicate fairly well. But I still wasn't from there.
Yeah.
And they kind of knew that. And so that sense of then trying to work out where I belonged, I think all of that. And I think also, I, unlike a number of people, a number of my peers at that time, the fact that I didn't belong in either, I ended up seeing as a positive. And it, I suddenly realized that I was in a position to be able to cherry pick the best of my kind of British upbringing and my Indian heritage.
Obviously, you have travelled so extensively around it. You mentioned your fantastic BBC documentary series that you made, which I actually, it's still on iPlayer. I watched an episode of it last night and I loved it.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, as someone who has spent so much time there, I'm always curious, as someone who is keen to travel there myself, you know, what would be your hidden gem in India, or, and your favourite city? What are kind of like a few of the things that you would mark out as the places you feel most passionately about?
It differs depending on the question, in a way, because if you're going to India for the first time, I think that the first best bet is Rajasthan. I think Rajasthan has got the forts, Jaipur, Udaipur, Jodhpur, the Lake Palace in Udaipur.
Oh yeah. I've seen photos of it. It looks so beautiful.
Yeah, it's where it's the scale of it. You know, you've got, you know, a lot of the cities feel, you can sense the history, because a lot of them you can see a sort of medieval past. these huge forts that kind of dominate the skyline and the town and the city, and then the city before it. And it's the scale of it. I mean, I remember going to various cities in Rajasthan and thinking, gosh, this is something like out of Lord of the Rings. I mean, it's just the scale of it is enormous. And that sense of India and history, I think you get from Rajasthan. But also, you know, it's a country of variety. So, you know, going up to the Himalayas, to the hill stations, Shimla is one that I've been to a few times, Darjeeling, where you can, on a clear day, I think you can see four of the five highest peaks in the world and the tea gardens. And I think if you drive up, I think you can only drive or get a train up to Darjeeling from the base. You go through every season, you know, as you go up, as you're going up higher. That's all extraordinary. And in the south, you've got Kerala and the beaches and Goa and the cosmopolitanness of of the cities of Mumbai. And I mean, in the center of it, there are jungles. You know, there was the one doc when we went to a tiger reserve, and, you know, going through the jungles of that just felt like a completely different experience to anything else around India. And also, you know, the other thing with India is that, you know, if you go in the south, any knowledge of Hindi doesn't really help you. So I remember thinking this or discovering this at the time when I was making that doc, which was that, you know, there are more English speakers in India than the entire population of the United States. So, you know, you can get by with English. English is the commercial language. So you can get round the country in English, but the variety within the country in terms of the food and, you know, languages around you and all that changes enormously. In terms of hidden gem, the one place that was off the beaten track that I didn't really know about that we filmed at was a place called Ellora, which is a couple of hours flying time north of Mumbai. And they have caves there. They have kind of, I suppose they are caves. There are caves that have been hewn out of the side of a rock, mountain, cliff. But some of these are so huge. I mean, we're talking 2-3 stories high. That they took the side of a mountain and basically started chiseling down and chiseling in to make not only the facade of, you know, a temple or whatever, but rooms and stairs within it.
Extraordinary.
It's all hewn from solid rock. And that was an extraordinary thing. It's something I didn't really know about, but we filmed there. Did I film it for the year? Filmed it for that. And that was amazing.
So chapter 4 is your all-time favorite destination. So hard to pick for everyone, but what would stand out to you?
Well, I've also already mentioned Italy, and I think that is my go-to place, actually, for the reasons I mentioned. You know, on every 100-yard loop, there's something historical, something aesthetically beautiful, or somewhere to eat. Amalfi was where I started. Amalfi and then Napoli and then Vesuvius, which was, and Pompeii, which is amazing in itself. But then, you know, when I went to Rome, I just thought, this is the best walking city I've ever been to. And although I kind of, you know, I've come to love Paris as well, I think it's a beautiful city. I think Rome for me was on a different level. At Venice, again, it's something, it's out of a movie set. It's amazing and extraordinary.
It is.
Sicily, is, you know, there's a living volcano. I mean, it's you can climb up it. Sardinia I went to. So, there's big chunks of Italy that I haven't been to, but I've yet to be disappointed.
The thing with Italy is that almost you could just have a lifetime of travels there and it would satisfy every desire.
Yeah, I mean, I could just go there and eat, which I do, obviously. The food's amazing.
What's your go-to?
Oh, it's just, I mean, you know, you're in Italy. It's Parmigiana. Parmigiana is my go-to dish in Italy.
Oh, it's making me hungry just thinking about it. So chapter 5 is your hidden gem, a place that you love that maybe my listeners wouldn't have known too much about.
Shimla, in India, in the foothills of the Himalayas, that's a special place for me. My dad, after partition and being a refugee in Delhi, he then went up to Shimla and got a job in the police office as a clerk. And that was the last job he had before he came to London. And so whenever I've gone to, I went to Shimla as a kid and I've been there to film. And also there's a little theatre there, which actually Michael Palin went to when he did his mm-hmm. Himalayas program. I remember yeah. talking to Michael about it, actually, and where he was introduced as Michael Palin. So it's something that I still call him. But it was the British summer capital. And so it's built on the side of a hill. And what dominates the skyline is an old church, an old kind of cream-coloured church, which sits at the top. And the road in front of it is called the Mall. And so my dad spent, you know, a few years there in his kind of like late teens and early 20s. And so it has an emotional connection for me. But I remember saying it's like a kind of, you know, a home county's town got together with an alpine town and had a baby.
Oh, that sounds so wonderful in a way. It really does.
And it's because it's up in the foothills, you know, foothills makes it sound lower than it is. You know, within an hour, you can have vistas of the Himalayas.
And the air is thinner and it's cooler.
Yeah, it's really unlike, you can suddenly understand why the Brits all kind of went up to Shimla for the summer, because Delhi was stifling. Yeah, that for me.
It's sounds little, quite romantic.
I think it is. I think it is romantic. You know, there's lots of monkeys jumping around and steal your food. As I said, it's not that hidden, but I still think it's a bit of a gem.
Well, speaking of romance, am I right in thinking that you fell in love with your wife, Meera Sial, the actress, on a plane?
Well, we've tried to work out, you know, it's very difficult to work out when, you know, when you do fall in love.
Yeah, that official moment. Yeah, it's moment. Not normally like one moment, yeah.
Yeah, there's no Cupid that you suddenly do pulling out an arrow from your backside and going, oh, thanks, I'll make a note.
I'm in love.
Thank you. It was going to Australia, and you know, it's a very long flight.
It sure is.
So it was 23 hours, and it was just me and her, and we were going there to do publicity stuff for the Kumars, which is a series we both used to do, Kumars number 42.
Oh, one of my all-time favorites.
Oh, thank you, mine too. And the film of Meera's first book, Anita and Me. And so we went there to do publicity for a week or so. I mean, it's a fantastic trip. I mean, I absolutely loved Australia, loved Sydney, loved the directness of the Australians. And we only went to Sydney and Melbourne, really, and then came back, which was another 23-hour flight. So, you know, Meera's always kind of quite rightly said that, you know, when you've got a flight that's that long, something's going to happen. Good or bad.
Were you sitting next to each other?
We were, yeah.
That's quite a bold move in itself. I mean, I assume that you are good friends, but I mean, that extended period of time together is a long time for anyone.
Yeah, we'd worked together for about, so it's about 7 or 8 years that we'd worked together. But, you know, when we were working together, we kind of only saw each other at work. You know, you have this intense period of 2 or 3 months where you come into work and you do the stuff and then you go home. And so we didn't really see each other outside of that until, you know, much later, until the, you know, certainly Goodness Gracious Me had finished. But certainly, you know, at that point, we were also both single, which wasn't the case when we first met either. Neither mm-hmm. of us was single. And so, yeah, it was something I had to give. Either we come back not getting on at all, or you get married. I think those are the rules.
That's lovely. I love it. You should tell the airline that you flew with, and maybe then you get free flights for the rest of your life or something. It's really amazing. I mean, because time has passed since the Kumars, it's easy to forget that, you know, clearly it was a big sensation in Australia. It won an Emmy, you know, which is out of the US, an international Emmy. Is that right?
One, two.
It won two Emmys, exactly. Two Emmys. So, I mean, how surreal was that for you?
Yeah, utterly surreal. Utterly surreal. I mean, the thing is that, you know, my sense memories and my sense associations of getting on a plane are still the same as when I was seven, which is that you leave a place that you're familiar with, get in this little tube, and then a number of hours later, you come into this world that you kind of go, wow, this is completely different. And in addition to that, to then be recognized for something that you do is a whole other cake. Yeah. You know, it's not even just a cherry on the cake. I remember in Australia, when we landed at sort of like early hours, 5, 6 in the morning. And I think it was a baggage handler who just looked at me and he said, you doing some shows over here, mate? And I said, I'm sorry, who are you talking? And he said, you're Blake from the Kumars, aren't you? And that really blew my mind. It was kind of, that's not what I associate with getting off on a plane and arriving in a different country. And, you know, there's a bit of me that's used to it, but mostly it still takes me by surprise. I remember Johannesburg. I remember a couple there approached me that was still in the airport who came up and said, you know, oh, we loved your show, The Kumars. Is it ever coming back? You know, it's kind of, it's a bizarre thing.
Coming back?
Well, you know, obviously me and Mira, you know, we're kind of ready to
it's
do it.
It's quite easy for you to have a convo, isn't it?
It is relatively easy for us. And also, you know, the weird thing will be that, you know, Mira's character will not have aged. She'll still be looking 80. I'd love to do it again.
Oh, well, we'd be very, very excited were it to make a return. But in the meantime, we've got Unforgotten to be excited about, which is back for its fourth season. Such a huge success. But I have a lot of international listeners who might not be familiar with it and who might want to get stuck in from the beginning. So would you be able to tell us just a bit about the show as a whole?
Yes, if there's a format to the show, it is about, so I suppose, cold case murders. So in the very first series, it's a body that's discovered in the basement, the foundations of a house. And they managed to find out that this was a young man that was killed in the early to mid 70s, 1970s. So it meant that as they follow up on the clues that, you know, the very sparse clues that this body, these bones have given you, they track down the people who are of interest, who are now all elderly. And so they are people that have spent 50 years are having a life of having kids, of achieving things in their lives and you know, socially. And so that was the really interesting thing about it, was that we then followed, you know, these four or five people. And the story was as much about what happens to those people and their families when they get that knock on the door from the police, who kind of say, do you remember this person? Didn't you kind of, weren't you connected with them somehow? And so each of the series has done that, in that we meet the people who may be connected to the person who died many years ago, and we look at their lives. We look at, you know, because everybody has a secret, and, you know, each series kind of explores what the uncovering of that secret means to each of those characters. So the whodunit in the end is one small part of what you get. I've always described it as four mini dramas sitting inside a whodunit. I play one of the coppers, so I'm one of the detectives. And I think that also the show has a lot of heart. I think that the interesting thing about, because you don't think these things when you're making it, but the thing that's been commented on, certainly from viewers here and from different parts of the world, the United States in particular and Australia, has been the relationship between the two main detectives, which is, you know, a warm, respectful friendship.
Yeah.
And so there's a heart to the procedural part of the drama. But, you know, each one of those mini dramas could be a season on its own. So it's incredibly rich writing.
So if you hadn't watched the previous seasons, you could come in with this new season and understand it all and really enjoy it.
Absolutely. I'd always suggest starting with series one. But yeah, you can jump in on any of those.
Fantastic. So let's pause there then for a second and move on to chapter 6. That is your worst travel experience.
Well, my worst travel experience isn't associated with the place, but it was the experience.
Yep.
So it is Paris. Paris, a city of love. La ville de l'amour. So it was the first place outside of school trips that I'd ever traveled to. And it was, at the time, it was to meet a girlfriend and probably the first person I fell in love with. And she was working in Paris for a year, which was, to me, was really exciting. It was, wow, you know, not only do I get to see her, but I get to see Paris.
Yeah.
And so I worked, I did temp work to save up enough money to go over on the train and the ferry, because that was the cheapest way of getting there. And I was going to be there for 5 days and then come back. And she was staying in some apartments. And you know, obviously, I was going to stay with her. And that was all. I was really excited. I hadn't seen her for a couple of months by then. The odd phone call and a couple of letters. And so 5 days. I was going to spend 5 days with her, you know, in the City of Love. And on day two, she dumped me.
Oh, and no.
So I was, but I was still stuck in Paris for another 3 days. And as I couldn't, you know, I couldn't afford to buy another ticket or, you know, to just get the train back that I was booked on. So I had 3 days of walking around the City of Love. I still went to the sites, still went to the Eiffel Tower and the Champs-Élysées, and but just as a slightly kind of depressed, bitter and twisted individual. I remember kind of watching all these couples just, you know, in my head going, oh, you look so happy now. Mm-hmm. You just wait. And then wandering up to the, you know, Eiffel Tower and say, dernier étage, s'il vous plaît. So it was such a kind of painful association that I then refused to go back to Paris for years.
Really? Really?
And I then went back to do a film. I filmed in Paris, and that was the reason I was going back. And arrived at the station, Gare du Nord, and I was traveling with people and got in the taxi. And I remember the first 5 minutes of driving away from the station, I just felt this well of kind of sadness at what the younger me had to go through. And I just thought, you poor kid, you know, that's a shame. And since then, I've loved it.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you kind of had closure on that experience and that now you can see Paris again with fresh eyes. So we're on to the final chapter of your Nice Travel Diary, Sanjeev, and that is chapter 7, which is the destination that's at the top of your travel bucket list.
I mean, it's so difficult. I mean, the world is such an extraordinary place. And, you know, in anybody's lifetime, you know, even if you're Michael Palin or you're Alan Wicker, going back even further, you know, you get to experience such a small part of it. So there's so much to see. And now, you know, just to confuse things, they kind of go, hey, you can sign up to go into space. So in terms of places that I've not been to that I think I would love to go to first, I think would be New Zealand. And I think it's mainly down to, well, it's down to two things. It's Flight of the Conchords, who I think are very funny and brilliant. And obviously, Lord of the Rings. Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't think of a series of films that could be sold as a, you know, travel advert than Lord of the Rings.
Exactly. The landscape.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, the variety within the landscape as well, you know, from, you know, volcanic rock to ice-covered mountains to kind of beaches to forests. It just looked amazing. And so, yeah, I think New Zealand for me, as a film fan and somebody who likes kind of comedy, then I just kind of go, okay, thank you, Flight of the Conchords, Britt and Jermaine, and thank you, Peter Jackson, New Zealand.
Fantastic. Oh, well, thank you so much for your time, Sanjeev. Those were your travel diaries. It's been such a pleasure to chat to you.
It's been an honour, Holly. Thank you.
That was a fantastic Sanjeev Bhaskar. I really hope you enjoyed hearing his travel diaries. Unforgotten airs on Monday nights on ITV at 9 p.m. Thank you so much for listening today. If you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you're updated with a new episode each week. And if you can't wait till next week, or if you're new to the podcast, remember there's the first 3 seasons to catch up on, from Michael Palin and Rick Stein to Dev Patel, Poppy Delevingne and Richard Branson. To find out who's joining me next week, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I would love to hear from you. I love reading all of your messages. And share your own travel diaries using the hashtag TheTravelDiaries. I'll be resharing your hidden gems, your recommendations and all-time favourites on my Instagram and here on the podcast later in the season. Thanks again for listening, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.